Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Spectators podcast. I'm Kate Andrews. As the UK's vaccine rollout provides a way out of the COVID pandemic, we are set to discover a host of new crises created over a year spent in and out of lockdown. The cancer crisis is just starting to unfold, as it's estimated around 3 million people miss cancer screenings between last April and August alone. How do we begin to play catch-up as NHS waiting lists grow? What could have been done differently? And what lessons can be learned to help cancer patients access faster and better care? Joining me today to discuss all of this, we have Delph Morgan, Chief Executive of Breast Cancer Now, Professor Peter Johnson, the National Clinical Director for Cancer at NHS England, Gordon Wishart, the Chief Executive for Check for Cancer, and Neil Pumford, the Asset Strategy Lead at AbbVie. This podcast is kindly sponsored by AbbVie. So Gordon, I'm going to start with you. Perhaps you can describe what has happened to cancer care since the pandemic first struck.
Yeah, well, I think lockdown had two main effects on cancer services in the UK. Firstly, with the stay-at-home message, trouble seeing a GP, and then the disruption to cancer services due to the redeployment on COVID, we saw about 350,000 less urgent cancer referrals in 2020. In addition to that, we had suspension of the NHS cancer screening programmes. We normally screen somewhere in the region of 200,000 people a week for breast, bowel or cervical cancer, and we normally diagnose about 400 screen-detected cancers a week. So the combination of both of those things has resulted in somewhere in the region of 40,000 people who were undiagnosed in 2020, and some of those may remain still undiagnosed. And I think as a result of that, the more worrying statistics that are coming out now is that we're seeing a later stage presentation, with something like 7% of people now presenting with stage 4 cancer, whereas they would have presented earlier than that. And that's particularly apparent in lung, bowel and prostate cancer. And that shift to later stage is really going to have a devastating impact on those patients and their families, but also on cancer survival rates, which were at best mediocre in the UK prior to the pandemic.
And Delith, is your campaign, Breast Cancer Now, seeing a similar worrying trend?
We're definitely seeing a similar pattern in Breast Cancer Now. For example, we estimated that around 1.2 million breast screens did not go ahead during the thick of the pandemic, and we're looking at about 90,000 less referrals through to a specialist, again because of either people not coming forward or there being some concern on behalf of GPs about referring people into, you know, secondary care because of worries about COVID. So there's, you know, real concerns there, but also thinking that our calculations suggest that we could be looking at about 11,000 breast cancers that are currently undiagnosed in the community. And of course, this means that there is a huge pressure coming down the track on breast cancer diagnostics and then potentially on services from there on. And so I suppose, you know, my main worry at this point in the conversation is about the workforce and how we make sure that we're getting the arguments across for longer term investment in the workforce so that we can not just recover, but as we many of us have said, build back better so that we can make the most of the opportunity that all the learning from the pandemic and the, you know, the devastating experiences have taught us for the future.
Neil, was there a noticeable pandemic impact on the work that AbbVie is doing?
In two spaces. I mean, firstly, you know, as Gordon and Delith have mentioned, you know, we see this kind of three stages to, you know, getting patients to the right cancer therapy. There's the screening stage, the diagnostic stage, and then the treatment stage. And all of those obviously have been impacted through COVID-19. So, you know, there are implications there in terms of, you know, the quality of life and the life expectancy of patients going forward. I know that the NHS have tried to pivot and introduce some kind of short-term access to, say, COVID-friendly medicines that maybe are oral or can be given out with the hospital settings. That's made a difference. And so certainly on that kind of one side, we've seen an impact. But actually, the other side, in terms of the clinical research, the clinical trials that we're doing for medicines in development coming through, there's been a huge impact. I mean, I think one of the stats I saw somewhere was that, you know, in early 2020, 95% of trials in cancer had been paused or stopped at that stage. And, you know, there's an issue now in terms of how quickly we can restart those trials and get back on track, if ever.
Peter, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, what do you think NHS England would have done differently when it comes to cancer patients?
I think it's important to recognise that the NHS has worked incredibly hard in the face of the pandemic to make sure that we maintain cancer services at as near to normal levels as we possibly could. Now, clearly, given the pressures that came onto the NHS this time last year, that was a real struggle, and our first priority was to make sure that we protected cancer patients against the risk of coronavirus itself. And I think with the shielding and with the adjustments to treatment that we made, that was very effective. And we look at the mortality figures that came out of the Office for National Statistics, and we can see that cancer patients didn't suffer great excess mortality compared to anyone else in the population, which was very reassuring. That suggested that we were successful in protecting people. But of course, if intensive care units are full of people with coronavirus, we can't carry out all the major surgical operations that we would normally be carrying out. And we needed to make big adjustments to the way that we looked after people. So we did see a downturn in urgent cancer referrals. And we know that if we look back over the last year, we have diagnosed less people with cancer than we would have expected. And the numbers of that are in the tens of thousands. And a small number of those are people that have not come through breast cancer screening. Another similar number of people are people with early stage prostate cancer and with skin cancer. And then smaller numbers of people with things like lung cancer and bowel cancer. So I think a lot of the people that we haven't seen, and if you look at the numbers, it equates to about 6 weeks worth of normal work. So we're essentially 6 weeks off the pace that we would normally expect to be at in terms of numbers of people we've been seeing. But many of those people will be people with the relatively slow growing types of cancer. And very encouragingly, although we saw a downturn in referrals with people of cancer of all stages, both advanced stage and early stage cancer, we haven't seen a big increase in the numbers of people with late stage cancer as yet. I have no doubt that there are some people who have not come forward, not been seen by their GP, not come through the system, whose cancers may be more advanced than we would have expected. But happily, I don't think the numbers of those are large, and certainly we haven't seen that so far. And very importantly, we've seen no increase in cancer mortality rates. And if anything, in the last part of last year, which is where we have the figures for, they've been running less than normal. So nobody's complacent and nobody would pretend that everything had carried on normally. But I think the adjustments that we were able to make to the system, introducing more COVID-friendly drugs that were less suppressive of the immune system, changing the way that we give radiotherapy so that people needed less visits to hospital, making sure we had surgical hub processes set up so that people who needed operations, if necessary, could have them done in different places than they had originally been planned. All of those things allowed us to maintain as much cancer diagnosis and treatment work as we possibly could. And happily, in the early part of this year, the next wave of coronavirus infection which came through, we didn't see nearly such an effect on cancer services as we had done the first time. And now looking at the figures for February, it looks as though we're pretty much up to normal and in some cases above normal levels of activity. So I think the NHS has taken a lot of trouble to prioritise cancer treatment. Of course, nothing during the last year has been normal, but it is very reassuring to see that we are getting the numbers of people being referred in and being diagnosed and treated back up again.
Of course, many of the questions are around what's going to happen now years in the future, with experts warning that excess cancer deaths could be anywhere between 7,000 and 35,000 due to the pandemic. Gordon, quite early on, you were warning about this kind of outcome, saying in April last year that what was happening in the NHS could lead to catastrophic cancer delays. Do you think those warnings were heeded?
Certainly, a lot of us were writing, predicting that, you know, there could be a huge impact on cancer survival. And I'm not sure they have been fully acknowledged by government. One of my big concerns is that quite early on, the NHS requisitioned the whole of the private sector in terms of hospitals and clinics. And actually, during the 12 weeks of the main first lockdown, those private hospitals lay virtually empty, apart from one or two which did work well to treat a number of NHS patients. But I think that was a big opportunity that was missed. And I suppose my biggest concern now is that, as you've just said, we won't see changes in survival, especially for things like breast and other cancers, perhaps for several years. And there's very little flexibility in the workforce that deals with cancer in the NHS. And it doesn't really matter whether 400 patients get referred with breast symptoms 1 month or 1,000. They still have to be seen. And so I just think the NHS is not in a great state to be dealing with the backlog while still trying to drive forward and maintaining current cancer services.
Peter, do you want to come back on the idea of missed opportunities? And there was a shift, wasn't there, between the first lockdown and the second and the third, where messaging from the NHS changed to really encourage non-COVID patients to come forward. That would suggest some kind of lesson being learned looking at the first lockdown.
When we saw the numbers of urgent referrals go down very sharply in April and May of last year, once we had got through the process of trying to make sure we were protecting people from the coronavirus, from the very start, we knew that we would have a job to do to make sure that we continued to bring people forward. So we started public campaigns, the Help Us to Help You campaign, in the late part of the summer, and have continued that through. We started with people with general cancer symptoms, then we moved on in the late autumn to people with abdominal symptoms, particularly focusing on those. And in February, we launched our lung cancer symptoms campaign as well, all very much targeted at the groups of people and the demographics where we knew that we'd seen the biggest downturn in referrals. So we've gone out very deliberately to try and make sure that we were encouraging people to come forward. And people, very understandably, didn't want to bother the NHS when they thought it was very busy, didn't want to bother their GPs when they knew they were very busy, and, of course, latterly, the vaccination programme. And it's a question of getting the nuance right to make sure that the people who have got the symptoms really do feel able to come forward and to present. It's important to make the point that in our urgent cancer referral pathways, we see on a usual year about 2.5 million people a year in order to diagnose about 160 or 170,000 cancers through that route. And those numbers have been going up year on year as we've been more successful at promoting the idea of coming forward with symptoms. But we have to recognise that more than 9 out of 10 people who come through those pathways, who are referred in that way, don't have cancer. So there's a huge amount of activity going on in the NHS to not diagnose people with cancer, and trying to work out how we can streamline those pathways and how we can make them more efficient for the future is really important.
Delith, of course, waiting lists, trials, preventative care are extremely important when it comes to this topic, but charities are also struggling. Cancer Research UK reported a halving of their income due to the pandemic, and falls in incomes have been seen across the board. Has this been a struggle for breast cancer now as well? And what does this fall in income mean for the future of research in cancer?
Well, absolutely. It's been a struggle for us at Breast Cancer Now. We've seen a drop in income of about 30% for this year. We're hoping to build that up in the short term and go back to levels that we once knew. But that has a direct impact on research. We've had to cancel research rounds. And of course, that has an impact particularly on early career scientists who would normally be supported by us. And this, of course, is something that is reflected across the charity sector. The National Cancer Research Institute estimates about 150 million of cancer research funding a year is lost currently, and how that's going to be replaced and the impact that will have on the cancer research ecosystem is something that's really worrying, because we all know, everyone on this call will know, that patients will do better generally in a research active environment where their caregivers are part of that striving for new knowledge and better ways of doing things, whether it's formally as part of clinical trials or whether it's just about evaluating and constantly learning how to improve services. So the impact of the pandemic, it isn't only about reductions in people coming forward for diagnosis and the impact that might have. It's also about how the whole system is going to work. There's no doubt in my mind that the cancer programme and Peter's colleagues have absolutely you know, strained every sinew to do their best. But the whole system has got to be looked at. Charities, not only could we not fund research, we weren't able to provide that face-to-face support that we've been giving along the way. So patients who would normally have us holding their hands through the diagnosis process haven't been able to have that and have had to revert to accessing support services digitally. And lots of charities have done a really brilliant job on pivoting for that. So there's a whole system approach and how we can work for the future to absolutely do our very best to learn and deliver progress.
Neil, where at all can the private sector step in and provide the support or fill in some of the gaps that Delith is talking about? Or is this now simply a matter of more taxpayer resources to tackle the problem?
I mean, I think to answer your question, Kate, and also to come back on a couple of key points that were made, I think, by Peter and maybe Gordon earlier on. So in terms of patient awareness, I think Peter made a very good point that, you know, more outreach, more awareness of symptoms, et cetera, you know, is absolutely needed in the UK to try and get more people coming in. And that kind of is the second part of this first piece, is that patient involvement and choice, we believe, is critical throughout this. You know, patients need to be part of a choice, not only of where their care is given, is it in hospital or out of hospital, you know, outpatient, etc., and also the treatment, because there's quite a variance in the treatments, as we've seen through COVID. Some can be given relatively easily outside the hospital environment. Some still need an infusion clinic. And of course, those were impacted more severely than other services. So patient awareness and choice, we believe, is critical, and industry can play, hopefully, a role in that going forward. I mean, certainly, you know, in terms of innovation of medicines, we can look at how those are developed to fit that outpatient setting more in the future. The second aspect is the clinical research and trials. And I think, again, you know, I think, you know, Delith mentioned this, we've got to take our hats off to the research setting in the NHS through this COVID period. I mean, I'm now in a global role for AbbVie, but I always look on pride back on where I think the UK is leading, and certainly the research in COVID-19 with dexamethasone and a number of other agents has been hugely impactful for the global pandemic. We would then ask, from an industry perspective, how can we actually use those learnings in terms of the speed of setup of those clinical trials, and the engagement throughout the NHS can be used more generally, not just in cancer research, but other research going forward. You know, how are they able to get ethics committee approval in such rapid fashion, etc.? Because from our perspective, being a global company, you know, we look at each country in its own right regarding not only the quality of research, the access to people with that condition to be researched, but also the speed of setup. And the UK, fortunately or unfortunately, is competing against other countries. I mean, I know, for example, you know, the one country that surprised me, or maybe it shouldn't have surprised me, you know, on a global perspective, Israel, for example, is one of the quickest countries in the world to set up clinical research. And I'm sure the quality is and safety of patients is paramount in their minds. So, you know, can we in the UK mimic some of those timelines to first patient, first dose for clinical research?
One of the problems is that we just don't know how many cancer patients have gone missing in this process. NHS England data shows a 16% drop in cancer referrals between March last year and January this year. Gordon, what's your prognosis for people who haven't been identified, and what do we need to do for them now? Are the systems as they were operating before the pandemic really fit for purpose now?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think the point that Peter makes about streamlining current diagnostic services is really apt. You know, the recent NICE FIT study showed that if you take the FIT test, which we normally use for bowel cancer screening, and apply that to a group of people with bowel cancer symptoms, if you drop the threshold really low, so you pick up almost any blood at all in the bowel motion, you can pick out most of the cancers. So that's a very simple, cheap test that could be done in primary care by GPs to really reduce the number of people going to hospital and send the right people to hospital to be investigated. And I think it's a real opportunity for us to look at all diagnostic services to see how they can be streamlined going forward. It's also a chance to review our cancer screening services. You know, we're very much led by population-based risk. When you get to a certain age, I think there's a big opportunity to look at personal risk. A lot of people reach a risk where screening is effective at a much younger age, and we know most of the risk factors for the common cancers now, and with increasing use of questionnaires and DNA tests, we should be able to pick out higher risk people who might benefit from starting screening earlier. And then just to come back to something that Della said about the workforce, that the lack of funding for cancer charities is not just going to have an effect on patients because they can't access current trials. Many of the current cancer specialists have done research degrees that have been charity funded, and those specialists have gone on to lead and participate in future trials. And if that's taken away for a number of years, we're really going to affect cancer specialists of the future and their ability to lead and develop new cancer trials. So I think it's a, you know, the charity funding issue, I think, really needs to be addressed urgently.
Peter, to bring this podcast to a close, let's look to the future. One of the lessons of the pandemic is public and private collaboration, not least in vaccine development, but a very good example of where it's been so successful. Are there lessons here for the NHS in terms of accepting more help from the private and charity sectors to serve these patients? And if so, how do you think that's going to go down amongst the establishment?
I think the pandemic has, like many crises, produced a huge amount of ingenuity, and you've heard some of the examples of that already, and how we've been able to accelerate the process of bringing technology to bear on some of the problems. Gordon's example of fecal immunochemical testing to work out who's at most risk of colon cancer and how we can more rapidly bring them into the system, and we're piloting capsule endoscopy with cameras and so forth. All of these innovations are a reflection of the response that we've made to the pressures. And essentially, if you want to make organisations innovative and forward-thinking, there are two things you can do. One is to put massive external pressure on them. Well, we've done that pretty effectively with coronavirus. And the other is to make sure you've got enough time and space to think intelligently and to respond to the problem. And that has always been the problem in the NHS, is we've always been very strapped, very up against it in terms of our resource and our capacity. So building the capacity, we are, I'm glad to say, getting additional investment into the cancer workforce. The Health Education England recently approved a £46 million spending settlement to increase across all areas of workforce, medical, nursing specialists and so forth, which I think is going to be incredibly helpful and is just the start of the process. So I think we are responding well, and I think we're flexing. There's lots more to do, but I am optimistic, having seen the speed with which we can adapt. I now do all my multidisciplinary team meetings, which I do every week, to review new cases and recurrent cancers coming through our system, all done virtually, actually much more efficient than it used to be. Remote consultation has helped a lot. It's reduced the numbers of people sitting for hours in hospital waiting rooms, waiting for a short conversation, which could very easily have been done remotely, and which we should have done before, but frankly never got around to because there was never the headspace and the time and the slack in the system to do these things. So I think this has galvanised some very different thinking, and it has brought us together in a way which was there before. The NHS and the third sector and industry have always worked incredibly closely in cancer, and it's one of the features of cancer treatment and cancer research that there is this diverse system of different interactions. But I think it has cemented that and accelerated our thinking in so many different areas. So I am optimistic. I think we will continue on our trajectory. And there are a lot of things in the pipeline which I think will continue to drive up the speed with which we can diagnose and treat cancer.
Gordon, do you think the emphasis needs to be on finding more resources, capacity and slack in the system to be thinking about the bigger picture? Or do you think we need to be looking at the systems and the structure of the NHS as well?
Well, I think we actually need both. I mean, clearly we need additional resource and some innovative thinking to work out how to deal with this cancer backlog while maintaining cancer services. But if we look back at the CRUK report of 2019, it said that our mediocre cancer survival was due to inadequate early cancer detection and lack of access to optimal therapy. So I'd like to see much more emphasis on the early part of the cancer pathway and really focus on that early cancer detection, you know, and look at cancer prevention. I mean, how many people know that more than 50% of bowel cancer is preventable? How many people know that alcohol, obesity and smoking are significant risk factors for bowel cancer? So I think if we can throw some resource at looking at personal risk assessment, risk reduction, we can actually start to make some inroads into cancer prevention. And I think if we can focus on all parts of the cancer journey, not just diagnosis and treatment, but go earlier than that, this would be a great opportunity and something good to come out of what has happened.
Delith, where do you think the emphasis needs to be?
Well, I think the emphasis needs to be on being extremely realistic and pragmatic. And by that, I say, let's face up to the reality of the challenges in the workforce. As an example, we have in breast cancer, a quarter of breast radiologists are retiring in the next 5 years. So that is a really significant pressure. And that is, you know, that was a stat established before the pandemic. So we don't know how they're all feeling when they're all kind of living with the exhaustion that we know is staff are experiencing. So I think we have to be very, very pragmatic. And we do have to look across the whole pathway because, yes, prevention is extremely important. And it will be even more important that we act on prevention now in 5-10 years' time. But if we don't take any action, then, you know, that then we will have problems in the future. And there are, you know, our understanding of risk and, you know, particularly, you know, in breast cancer, you know, you're looking at, you know, real progress in terms of risk stratified screening potentially coming down the track. And that's a really big development that could be very important. But also, you know, if we're talking about access to optimal treatment, we need to be clear that, say, again, in breast cancer, as an example, 11,000 women and some men are dying every year, and they're dying because we don't have the optimal treatments that could extend their life. We don't know what those are for lots of people yet because they haven't been discovered, because of the research hasn't been done yet. But, you know, we need to know that when those new treatments, new innovative treatments come online, they will be available for those patients living within, you know, what's currently incurable disease. So we have to look at the whole pathway if we want, and prevention, if we want to be the best that we can be in terms of a world-class cancer service.
Neil, final word to you.
I'm not sure I can. I think the previous speakers have done a very good job of elaborating on where they see the priorities for, you know, the NHS going forward. I think the only thing I would mention is that, and I can give you maybe a very tangible example. So I'm involved in looking after potential medicines in very early stage, kind of phase 1, 2, 3 development. And we're making decisions now in terms of, you know, we have something that's given by intravenous infusion every 3 weeks. Can we make that a 4-week infusion? Can we even make it subcutaneous? Will that subcutaneous kind of injection be in an outpatient setting or potentially in the patient's home, depending on the side effects and risk? All of those questions we can't answer on our own. We can try and develop things, but we have to work closely with the NHS and other organizations going forward in terms of, you know, what does the service look like? What is good look like? And what do patients value? And what does the NHS as a payer value? And then make sure that we feed all of that in when we eventually are, you know, in the fortunate position of bringing these, you know, innovative medicines to the UK, to say, how do we actually value these from both the, you know, the payer's perspective and the patient's perspective as we work together through this period of time, and then, you know, have them available potentially to patients in the future. So, you know, we need to be communicating very well and collaborating very well to make sure that we get this right going forward.
Peter, Gordon, Delith and Neil, thanks so much for joining me.